This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Nearly three-quarters of our planet is covered by water, and yet it's estimated that we humans have set eyes on just 5% of the world's ocean. For that matter, we have better maps of Mars than we do of the sea floor. There's clearly a technical challenge in designing vehicles and instruments that can withstand the extreme conditions of the deep sea, but the sheer cost of getting scientists out to sea is another major obstacle. The Okeanos Explorer is a ship specifically designed to address these obstacles and accelerate exploration of the other 95% of the ocean. Owned and operated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, this ship is known as America's Ship for Ocean Exploration, and it's pioneering a whole new way of doing ocean science, one that uses communications technology to minimize costs while maximizing the number of scientists involved in exploring previously unseen parts of the deep sea. The Okeanos Explorer beams all of the mapping and video data it collects up to a satellite and back down to the internet, allowing scientists, students, and the public to follow along in real time. For some three dozen labs around the country, it's even better than that. They can also talk back to the ship in real time, commenting on what's being seen and helping make research decisions in collaboration with each other and the small science team that's on board Okeanos Explorer. Later this hour, we'll take a tour of the Okeanos Explorer and talk directly with the team currently aboard the ship in the Gulf of Mexico. But first, Tim Shank of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has been working with the Okeanos Explorer since its launch in 2010. We spoke with him last August at the end of a six-week cruise exploring undersea canyons off the east coast of the U.S.
Tell us about this live stream video technology. You've been doing this for a few years with a ship that is operated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where essentially you're going out and exploring, but you don't actually have to be on the ship. So what's the setup on the ship and what's the setup in your lab that's enabling this?
Yeah, that's right, Heather. Since 2010, we've been working with the NOAA Okeanos Explorer vessel to provide data real time through the internet, basically. So that we can observe the seafloor and go places we haven't been before. They're very hard to get to. And so in 2010, we went out to Indonesia. The deep sea in the north of Indonesia, the Sulawesi Sea, was really unknown at that point. No one had ever been down there before. And that's almost right in the heart of the Coral Triangle, a place that we know that has the most diverse deep sea life, shallow water sea life on Earth. And so we wanted to know if that translated to the deep sea. And so getting this ship, this dedicated ship of exploration, a dedicated ROV is what we had, a tethered vehicle. And I was the only scientist on board. It has a full operating ROV crew on board. It has videographers that do NFL football games, very high expertise on board the ship. It's dedicated for that sole purpose of exploring the seafloor, going where we haven't gone before, and transmitting that live back to shore for scientists to observe.
So just for a second, tell us about what the experience is like being on a boat doing science with a remotely operated vehicle. I mean, you're sitting in kind of usually just a trailer, right? Literally a trailer that comes off the back of a truck that
That's
is
right.
loaded with all of these video screens. You're sitting there with presumably other people who are operating the vehicle.
Yeah. And you typically have a pilot and a co-pilot, and you have a navigator who's sitting in the front row. You have a videographer or two that are sitting up in the front row, listening to your instructions of what you want to see. If you want to stop and image something, look at something, zoom in on something, get more information about something. You're in the back row. And again, I was the only scientist on board, a whole different paradigm. Normally you would have, maybe 18 scientists on board doing different disciplines, you know, biologists, geologists, chemists. But in this case, it was by myself, basically, and relying on those geologists and chemists back on shore to give me information. And so we were plugged in live to them in my little headset there. They could talk to me and I could talk to them. And they could tell me, Tim, we want to see this. Can you go back and look at this? Stop the vehicle. Let's look at this. And that's what we do. So as a team, we'd work together to explore and learn more.
So was it as good having them on the other end of your headphones as it was having them in the trailer there with you?
It's extremely difficult. Normally, you don't have that off-the-ship presence. And so all the people who are watching with you are in the room, like watching TV in your living room and having discussions. But when they're on the shore, you have to wait for them to get your message and come back to you. You're hearing the pilot speak. You know, three or four people are in your headset while you're trying to listen to somebody else on shore. It's extremely difficult. It's a whole new way of participating in ROV science.
Well, so and then now you've taken this 3 years later. This summer, you've just completed 6 weeks where, in fact, you weren't on the ship. There were two other scientists who were on the ship. But now you've got this much larger community. you were plugged into, what, something like 40 different locations via three or four different communications technologies. So talk a little bit about what was going on in your lab here in Woods Hole this summer.
It's grown tremendously. That first year we had maybe 10 scientists involved. And like you said, there were 40. There was actually over 700,000 people watching our three live feeds coming off the ship. In my lab, I had 8 people. I had summer student fellows, I had postdocs, I had technicians, I had graduate students, all learning about the deep sea in real time from the experts in the field, right? We were off 100 miles or so off of Nantucket, looking at deep water canyons, a place that's virtually unexplored. It's within our economic zone of the U.S., yet we know little about what lives there, the living resources, non-living resources. We had a lot of stakeholders involved who wanted to know about whether we have natural seeps of petroleum there. The oil companies wanted to know that. Fisheries biologists and the councils on the East Coast want to know what the fish are, what the deep water corals are. But without getting too far into that, we had teams set up around the country and around the world. We had some in France that were also watching us, interacting with us. It was fantastic. Heather, we were learning about the experience from other scientists and what they had done in deep water canyons or in the deep sea with their expertise.
Well, and you said at one point there was, I think it was a fish that nobody knew what it was, and you literally picked up a phone to someone who was not already plugged into the cruise and said, wake up, you know, in your time zone, you're still asleep, wake up, get on your computer, we need to know what this fish is now. So you could literally, it was kind of plug and play for scientists, right? You could just plug in the people who needed to be at any point.
We did that many times with sponges and with fish and with other animals, even with the geology. We plugged people in and say, hey, have you seen this before? And it really, what it's doing is it's advancing science at an accelerated rate. What would take us, we come back normally, right, with all of our data on hard drives, and we'd go through it, and we might send images out to people or talk to people at meetings and slowly gain, whoa, that was really new, right? And this now we're doing it while we're in real time, before we even, you know, the cruise is over, right? So I think it's accelerating the discovery of things in the deep sea for sure. I think it's going to push technologies even harder.
Obviously, there's a lot of technology involved in broadcasting this data back, but you're also getting a lot more people involved that you wouldn't be able to, the cost of putting that many people on a ship, you would never be able to do that. So is what you're doing a cost savings?
So this communication technology existed 30 years ago. This was done with Jason, where they would broadcast things. As soon as it was realized, you could broadcast from an ROV to the ship. Say, wait a minute, why can't we broadcast it off the ship by satellite? And they did that in the 80s. But mostly it went to classrooms. But now the bandwidth is so great, the internet's so great, that we have 3 streams coming off the ship. Anybody can tune in. I was watching it on my iPhone. It's that simple. I could hear all the scientists talking through the conference call that we do, see the video in real time with my iPhone, and I could dial in and call the scientists through that, right, driving down Woods Hole Road. So the technology is all there now, right? It's just what we're going to do. What are we going to do with it now that we have it, right?
You know, there's been a real blossoming of citizen science, this movement to get all sorts of people involved in the actual doing of science. But it's always been very hard to do that with ocean science because, of course, you can't get everybody out on a ship. Now you have the ability, as you said, there could be a class of a bunch of students on the conference call watching this feed, and they could literally say, hey, can you go back over there and look at this?
This is what was unexpected, I think, when we first started this. I mean, normally you go out to sea, again, you may have 18 scientists out there. They may have 4 or 6 graduate students out there doing their PhDs and very exclusive, if you will, right, for access. Now it's clear, like I told you, I had 8 people in my lab this summer. Now they came in with no knowledge of deep sea biology, and they're leaving now with, you know, they're writing reports on it. And so it's the reach is so far. And so what do you do with the students when you're not just having them watch passively like it's TV or something? They're calling and talking to the scientists. They're generating reports and making catalogs and inventories of what we're doing. I mean, so we're actually doing presence and absence data, for example, of corals, and I'm having them analyze it right now today. And so we're able to use these real-time data and post-processing to educate these students.
So you're accelerating the pace by having everybody feeding in at the same time and talking to each other. But are there actual discoveries that wouldn't have happened even eventually, that would never have happened, or outcomes coming out of this cruise that would never have happened if you hadn't had everybody working on it all together?
Well, there's no doubt. First of all, we would never have had the cruise. There are very few places or agencies that will fund exploration, period. And we had the experts around the world saying, you know, we never get to do this. So, we never get just to go look and experience and take our time. So
when you say exploration, what do you mean? Isn't that what is being funded when we go out on these ships with AUVs or ROVs or with Alvin? Isn't that exploration?
No, you don't get the privilege of using those vehicles unless you have written a proposal that has well-defined hypotheses, well-constrained experiments, has to have clear results that are going to lead you to a certain conclusion either way. That's science. That's a scientific method, right? And so what we often lack is the enough information and data to write that proposal. How do you write a proposal on the canyons we have out here off our coast if we don't know what's out there at all, right?
So this is giving you the ability to just
it's opening up
go look and
new avenues of research. Absolutely. No doubt about it.
I mean, that's what it felt like when I was in the lab with you, was that it was literally almost like just kind of going for a walk on the bottom of the ocean.
The fear that you have is that people take this as a gee whiz thing. We're going down there and we're looking in that. What beautiful imagery we have. We have some of the best cameras, you can get. And so it's not just gee whiz, golly, what nice images. First of all, it took a year to get to this point for this Canyons cruise, for example. We had workshops and meetings that people defined what they wanted to do. We had preliminary hypotheses about what we thought might be there. Right. And why? And that sets us up. Right. It gives us a framework to go out and explore. I mean, these canyons go from 400 meters down to 4000 meters. Where are you going to go? You're going to cover maybe a half a mile during one dive. Right. And there's millions and millions and millions of square miles out there. So we have to narrow that down to begin with. So there's a scope already when we go out and explore. It's not just random walking. Right. We have a purpose behind it. And that's really important for people to understand. And when it comes to what we're seeing, right, and what we're conveying to our graduate students, what is benefiting our research, is like drinking from a fire hose. You know, you were in there seeing us at some pace that we've come to have on these dives. We stop and we look at certain things, right? As we go along, we document things. We have questions about things that we know are going to feed into proposals for us to come back and do research. You know, we have daily phone calls with the scientists. After the dive is over, we come and we gather on a conference call. We give summaries and we give our impressions and our thoughts. And through those, we're developing new collaborations. And now I think we're up to perhaps 14 types of publications that we do as scientists already on this. So it's not let's go look, gee whiz. It's what's going to enable our science in the future if we go and look here.
Let's talk about the collaborations that come out of this as well. Because, of course, when you've got 40 people talking to each other, some of what happens is that you start talking about we need to work together more on this. And that is in and of itself a tangible scientific outcome from these cruises, isn't it?
Absolutely true. You might gain that at some sort of a national meeting or something like that, and you would find someone to connect with them and share your interests. But you're developing these relationships in real time. And when it's over, you've shared an experience. You know, everybody's sort of shaking hands at the end saying, what a great job. Nice. Let's keep talking about this. Remember, we wanted to do that. And, you know, so you're absolutely right. This is a benefit that people maybe didn't see before when we started this. But definitely having a major collaborations coming out of this.
Now, the ROV that you've been using with the Okeanos is purely going down and taking video. There's no ability to grab a sample to pick stuff up while you're down there.
Right.
There are other ROVs that have that ability, that have a robotic arm on them, and you can say, I want a piece of that. So do you ever wish that you had, when you're on these telepresence cruises, that you had one of those robots? How important is it to be able to grab what it is you're seeing?
Well, it's extremely important. The imagery can only get us so far, even though it's really good imagery. It can only get us so far. We actually have to have a sample. We can't describe a new species from a picture, right? And so we all recognize that the current limitations are there. Now, that this ROV called the Deep Discoverer is new. This is its second science mission, right, of exploration. And it does have two manipulator arms, so it can sample. The issue when you have such an open community thing, I haven't told you that yet, but all the data here are shared. Everything that comes off the vehicle, all the depth and temperature data and all the video and still imagery, all gets archived in the National Archives. It's on an FTP site within 24 hours. It's total open source. And that's the way things are going. And so anybody can write any paper, do any proposal they want to, go out and make any collaborations they want to. The key thing will be for the future to see how we can get samples. Right now, what if you did sample a shrimp, for example, or a fish? There may be 20 people that want that fish. Right now, we haven't figured out the protocol for if we take a fish, who's going to get it because there's so many people that want it. It may be that we take that fish and we get, you know, accession it into the Smithsonian, some national archive, and then as we normally do, we make requests from that archive, and the person at the archive place has to deal with who's going to get that sample. But right now you can't cut a shrimp up into 10 bits and hand it out to 10 people.
So I mean, that's one of the challenges of opening this up to so many people is suddenly you've got this real conundrum.
That's right. And people want samples. We found what we think are many new species on this, fish and coral species on this recent cruise, and we desperately want those samples.
Do you worry that when you go back to get those samples, you might not be able to find that fish?
No, that's never really – that hasn't been a worry, actually. I think that, like I told you before, these cruises enable research to happen. They enable proposals and follow on. That's the real goal of these things, not to be the end-all, be-all, you know, get all research done.
You've been doing this for 3 years. Mm-hmm. We've had the ability to do this since the 80s. Mm-hmm. What's happening now that there's this sudden explosion in doing oceanography by remote feed like this?
That's a great question. What's happening now is that those scientists who get funded through, let's say, the National Science Foundation or other agencies to do their specific program and cruise like we talked about, they are now so interested in telepresence and presenting themselves and their project for education that they are now taking remote telepresence units out to sea with them. So our ship here, the Atlantis, has such a remote thing on it right now. So if there's an ROV dive off the Atlantis tomorrow, they can use telepresence. They can put that on the internet. People can look and participate as they will. So case-by-case basis for scientific research programs that are going out to sea now are incorporating telepresence more and more. There's a new web portal called Exploration Now, which actually features ships that have telepresence capabilities with different types of science programs on them. Some are exploration. Some are sort of the ships are hired guns by NSF or other agencies with specific research programs that people are going to feature. I did this last year on the Revel, the script ship Revel, and it was really fascinating to see a different approach. It wasn't exploration. We were doing our scientific mission, very, you know, constrained and determined, and we all sat in the chair and we conveyed our science and what we're doing. It was mostly one way, right?
Oh, so that's mostly a one-way thing.
We did not have other people participating on shore, you know, saying, you know, turn left, turn right, I want to see this.
Is there any pushback? Are there those in the community who don't necessarily think we should be opening it up in this way, that it should be just this more exclusive, the scientist, the credentialed scientist doing it, and it should just be a one-way feed?
What we're finding is that the more we do this sort of open communications, open scientific exploration that we're talking about, we get more and more people every year involved. More and more want to be on the ship and actually do the work on the ship. I think we're finding more and more that people who have funded programs want telepresence technology with them. They see it's a masterful way to educate the public and other people in schools and classrooms. And you know, you reach anybody you want to reach, right, immediately.
Dr. Tim Shank of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Tim, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll get a tour of the Okeanos Explorer. Stay with us. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're spending this hour getting acquainted with the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer and its novel way of doing ocean science, called telepresence. We recently visited America's ship for ocean exploration at its home port in Rhode Island. We started our tour with Lieutenant Brian Kennedy, the ship's operations coordinator.
Brian, where are we right now? What are all these screens for?
Right now, you're in the control room on the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer. This is kind of the nerve center of the vessel. All science and exploration activities are centered out of here, whether it be ROV operations, doing CTD cast, or collecting mapping sonar data.
How many screens do we have here, and what are we looking at on all of these different screens?
It has a mixture. This room is multipurpose. It can run three or four different types of operations. During ROV operations, which is primarily what this space was designed for, the left camera here is the ROV main HD camera, and the camera here on the right is usually the camera platform, or Sirius's main HD camera. The other screens around the perimeter are different situational awareness cameras or cameras on the ship monitoring the health of different systems like the traction winch and stuff like that.
And you were saying a few minutes ago you actually want more screens
in
here. Yes,
we are talking about adding a couple new sonars or some new equipment, and if we did that, we would probably need an additional screen or two. So we're talking about actually having a screen that fold down out of the ceiling when we're doing the operations that would use those sonars.
So how many people does it take to run this command center?
Right now, the ship, when she goes to sea on a science or exploratory mission, will have 20 mission personnel. And that's a mixture of two or three scientists and then, honestly, 17 or so technicians to make all this equipment work, whether it be ROV, telepresence, video, data engineers, stuff like that. We actually have to go to sea with different experts from so many different disciplines. We have mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, software engineers to all make this stuff work.
So how does that compare to the kind of crew that you would have on a more traditional research vessel where you've maybe got a larger scientific staff actually doing more experiments at sea instead of more of the vehicle-based operations?
If you're doing vehicle-based operations, you generally have to have an ROV team that can maintain the vehicle and whatnot. But what we do is add in the extra layer of telepresence. And what that allows us to do is leave the majority of the scientists on shore. So on a standard cruise, if you were out on Woods Hole's Atlantis or something like that, you would have an ROV team, and then you'd have a science team that was probably larger than the engineering group at sea doing all the data processing and analysis in real time. Whereas here on the Okeanos, we send the technicians out to sea and really leave the majority of the scientists on shore. We might have two scientists on board to work as the gateway between the data collection on the vessel and the scientific brain trust on shore. It's a more efficient operation because we're not using bunks for scientists. We can leave them at shore, and we concentrate the people who are needed to make the operation happen on the ship where they can actually fix things if they want or make improvements on the fly.
Talk about the economics of a telepresence model. How does the cost of having more people at sea compared to having all of this technology running?
It allows us to do operations with a little bit smaller vessel. A global class vessel like the Atlantis or the Roger Revelle or one of the other big ships, they can hold a lot more scientists on board, but you're limited to those people on board. On the Okeanos, it's a little bit smaller. We can't hold as many people on the ship, but we can have an infinite brain trust on shore. So it's really hard to quantify the economics of it, but what allows us to do is truly multidisciplinary ocean exploration, whereas we go to a place that we know nothing about. We really don't know what we're going to find. And depending on what we find that day, once the ROV gets on the bottom, we can reach out to people who will know their specific expertise and can participate, chime in, or it allows more people to be intimately engaged in what's going on.
So would you say this is kind of akin to the kind of exploration that, say, the Mars rovers are doing or that unmanned space vehicles are doing?
It's more so, yeah, because you've got the remote vehicle sending data back that technically an infinite N of scientists, number of scientists can participate and look through that data and advise the next series of activities. And it is more exploratory like that. I mean, if you think about the average model of a research vessel going to sea, you have a principal investigator, maybe two principal investigators, with a hypothesis they want to test. They want to go out, they want to collect a statistically significant sample, and they want something they can truly publish on. This vessel was designed and operated to be a hypothesis-generating vessel. We go places where no one's been before or very little research has been done in the past to see what's there, get a first-order characterization, really a baseline. And hopefully the scientists who participate in that, the scientists who look at our data after the fact, can then, hypotheses will come to them, theories that they can propose to come back with a dedicated group who can more specialized and study something and test a hypothesis later on.
Where are we in the stage of exploring the ocean in terms of having unexplored areas and needing to generate hypotheses versus getting to the point where most of what we're doing in terms of ocean science is actually testing those hypotheses?
95% of the ocean is unexplored. Even when we go to areas that are more a better idea of what's been developed there, we see things routinely that are unexpected. If we don't stump the scientists or get gasped from the science community about once every other day, we really don't feel like we're doing our job right.
At the rate that you're exploring the ocean, how long would it take you to cover the whole thing?
The continental United States is about 1% of the world's surface area. In a really good field season, we might map an area the size of West Virginia. And that's not even counting the ROV operations. Each ROV dive, if we're lucky, we cover a linear kilometer. So there's huge areas that are undiscovered. Our ROV is capable of going to 6,000 meters. The deepest spot in the ocean is about 11,000 meters. About 1% of the sea floor is below 6,000 meters. So there's a whole area of sea floor at about the size of the continental United States that our vehicle can't get to, and there's only, I don't remember the exact number, but single-digit number of vehicles capable of going that deep.
Jared Druniak is the telepresence engineer for the Okeanos Explorer. He explained how the ship's communication systems work and the benefits of the telepresence model for ocean exploration.
Walk us through what we're seeing on these different screens and kind of what would be going on in here if we were actually part of a telepresence cruise. Obviously, we'd have people in these chairs. What's everybody doing?
Starting from the left, that fire station is going to be navigation. Navigation's job is to communicate directly with the ships and the bridge's crew, with the rest of the ROV team, to make sure the ship is going where it needs to go, to make sure that there aren't any ocean liners or fishing vessels in our way. The last thing we want to do is get a multi-million-dollar vehicle tangled up in some fishing nets. Next to that, we have the two ROV stations. One will be for the ROV pilot, and the other is for the sled pilot. The system we use is actually it's a two-vehicle decoupled system. So the power, lighting, and direct mechanical connection is from the ship is to the sled. And then there's a 120-foot neutrally buoyant tether that connects the sled to the actual ROV. Moving over, we have the video station. I spend a lot of time here. From this station, you can send video from anywhere to anywhere in the ship. It's responsible for the three live feeds coming off the ship. It's responsible for the recording. It's responsible for playback. And it's also responsible for a lot of the communications. We utilize an RTS intercom system, very similar to an intercom you would use in a television control room, to have the scientists communicate with each other, have the deck crew communicate with each other, have the ROV crew communicate with each other, and have the ship scientists and the shore scientists be able to communicate.
Logistically, I mean, you've got these vehicles that are down on the bottom of the ocean. They're actually tethered to the ship by a cable, and that's fiber optic?
Well, it's more than just fiber optic. So it's a relatively thick steel cable. The cable is about an inch thick, and obviously it's up to 6,000 meters long.
The video is coming from the vehicle through that cable up to the ship, and then how does it actually get from here to the land-based scientists that are looking at it?
What happens is a suite of electronics on the ROV take that video signal as well as different data and different control signals and convert it to a pulse of light, fiber optic. Then that fiber optic is sent from the bottom of the ocean up into our control room where it's then broken out into its component parts, including signals, sensor voltages, control voltages, and the video. From there, the video goes through our ship's router and our encoders. From the encoders, it goes over a satellite, over an Internet 2 backbone. The reason we use Internet 2 is because it's fast enough to allow us a very, very low lag time. So we pipe our video feed, Internet 2, directly to ECCs, or electronic command centers?
Exploration command centers,
or ECCs. The reason we do this is that low 2 to 5 second lag time allows scientists to see things from the ocean floor about 2 to 5 seconds after they're actually happening. So that allows them to interact with us in real time. From there, then it goes to the Inner Space Center, where it is further distributed out over Internet 1, and then it goes to the general public. So viewers at home are still seeing the same images, they're just seeing them about 20 to 30 seconds later.
Telepresence requires more than just communications technology. Lieutenant Brian Kennedy took us up to the bridge of the Okeanos Explorer to explain.
So this is the bridge. This is where the officer of the deck stands watch. That person is responsible for the overall safety and navigation of the vessel at all times. They act with the authority of the commanding officer to execute standing orders and make sure that all operations are done according to his protocols and in a safe and efficient manner. One thing that makes this ship really different from many other research vessels is the Dynamic Positioning System, or DP. And that system allows the ship to hold very, very still in most sea conditions. The vessel is 224 feet, about 68 meters long, and when we're in DP, she can hold within 1 meter accuracy of wherever we tell her to. She can spin around on her axis, back forward, go sideways, any direction of motion is possible through the Dynamic Positioning System. And the way it does that is this really intelligent computer that has wind sensors throughout the ship and a 3D model of the vessel's profile. So when the wind gusts, the ship senses it, calculates the cross-sectional area of the wind forcing, and it will actually apply thruster force with the ship's propellers preemptively to counteract the ship's movement. So it compensates before the ship moves, which is how it allows us to stay so very still.
The high-resolution video data that Okeanos Explorer streams back to scientists on shore is gathered by a remotely operated submersible known as Deep Diver, or D2. It also has a companion vehicle called Sirius that helps operators keep an eye on D2 and protects the vehicle from motion at the sea surface. One of the engineers responsible for these vehicles gave us an up-close look.
So this is Sirius, the sled. Carl, tell us, what does this actually do when it's down on the bottom of the ocean?
Well, this is, we call it the sled. It hangs down on the steel cable off the fantail of the ship. And it is basically a big weight. And as the ship moves up and down, it moves up and down and takes all the wave motion away from the ROV. It's hanging about 60 feet above the bottom, generally. Besides being a weight, it's also keeping an eye on the ROV. That's a HD camera identical to on the ROV. And it's looking down, giving the pilot a spatial awareness. It has these six HMI lights, which create a giant pool of light on the seafloor. So as the ROV is driving around, it has more light to work with than just its own lights.
I mean, this is a lot of electronics for something you're describing as essentially a weight. What is all this doing?
If we start from the very front, you can see there's these thrusters. There's one on the front, one on the back. And they allow Sirius to keep its directional heading. So wherever the ROV is below it, it can turn and watch. And if there's ocean currents or if the ROV is pulling on Sirius, it keeps its heading.
So somebody up on the ship actually has to be driving Sirius at all times, as well as driving
There's two pilots. The main pilot and the co-pilot drive Sirius. There's a joystick to control heading. There's the winch control to move Sirius up and down. So the main cable comes into the junction box here from the ship. It splits out into these junction boxes and sends signal and power around Sirius and then also over to the ROV.
So then the Superstar is over here?
Yes.
Is this the front or the back?
This is the front. Again, a HD camera, two manipulators. These guys up here are lots of little LED lights. Sirius is hanging about 60 feet up. And then this ROV D2, or Deep Discover, flies around on the seafloor. It has this drawer here for putting any sensors that scientists would like. The manipulators for moving sensors around. There's another HD camera here that pans and tilts, gives you an overview of everything around. This guy here, we just call it the bubble cam for obvious reasons. And it also gives the pilot spatial awareness when you're using these from 6 kilometers above. You kind of need a lot of cameras to see where everything is. And then there's a bunch of small cameras scattered around to make sure you don't back over anything or see what's next to you. Other features of D2, we added these light bars. They're up right now, but these actually swing out to put the lights out to the side. There's more up top that swing out, so you end up with a huge light pool illuminating everything from all angles. D2 has the same type of thrusters as Sirius, but there are six of them. Inside there, you see the two the laterals that move the ROV side to side. Then on either side, there's two big verticals for going up and down. And on the back, there's two horizontals for going forward and backwards and for turning. This big white thing up here is the foam. It's very dense, it's little glass beads. So when you go down in the high pressure of the deep ocean, it doesn't crush. And it keeps D2 pretty much neutrally buoyant.
At any depth?
Yeah.
This is the tether, right?
This is the tether that goes from Sirius to the ROV. It's about 100 feet long. Pretty flexible, as you can see. So as Sirius moves up and down in the waves, the motion doesn't really affect D2. So all the power comes through the tether and fiber optic signals.
As vehicles go, is this a fairly large one, a fairly small one, compact?
It's pretty large. As you can see, it's about the size of a minivan, made to carry a lot of payload for a future, for whatever scientists would like to put on.
That was our tour of the Okeanos Explorer and its deep sea vehicles D2 and Sirius. Next up, a ship-to-shore conversation with the team on board the Okeanos Explorer. That's after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're spending this hour getting to know the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer and its unique way of conducting ocean exploration. We here at Living Lab have gotten rather hooked on the live video feed from the ship. You can watch some at our website, capeandislands.org. But our experience wouldn't have been complete without an actual real-time conversation with the team on board the ship. We recently spoke with Kelly Elliott, the expedition manager for the 2014 Gulf of Mexico expedition.
I'm coming to you right now from on board NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer. We're currently out offshore in the Gulf of Mexico conducting an ROV, or remotely operated vehicle dive, in Bryant Canyon. We've got the vehicle down on the seafloor, a little over 2,500 meters deep, I believe, at the moment, and we're sort of transecting a ridge of this canyon, looking towards the world and exploring the Boca community of this area. To our knowledge, no one has ever worked here before. And now here in the room with me, I have Jamie Austin. He's with the University of Texas at Austin, and he is our geological science, co-science lead for the expedition. I also have Mimi Lovecker. She is our mapping team lead, and Jared Druniak, our telepresence lead.
Great. Well, thank you guys all for taking some time away from your normal activities to talk with us. Could you just explain for us, what are the scientific goals of this particular expedition in the Gulf of Mexico?
Sure. So the 2014 Gulf of Mexico expedition, and really the expeditions conducted by NOAA Ship Oceanus Explorer, they're all community-driven exploration activities. So leading up to the start of this expedition, I, as the expedition coordinator, reached out to other programs and offices and labs within NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and I asked them, what are your priority areas for exploration in the Gulf of Mexico? And we received a tremendous amount of feedback, and topics range from areas where we just needed baseline mapping, basically maps of the seafloor that could help guide future exploration and research activities, to specifically wanting to identify the location of deep sea coral habitats, and or locations where there might be active oil and gas seeps and associated chemosynthetic communities of life. So our overall, and the information that we received helped to identify two primary operating areas for the expedition. One is in the northwestern Gulf of Mexico, and the other is off the central West Florida escarpment. And our overall goals are to conduct systematic ocean exploration out here and to explore the diversity and distribution of benthic seafloor habitats. So many of the dives that we're conducting here, almost all of them, are in areas that we've never seen before. We have no idea what's on the seafloor. We do have information from scientists that suggest they think there might be sensitive ecosystems at some of the locations where we're diving. We've also been conducting investigations on shipwrecks or areas where we think we might find the shipwreck on the seafloor. And these areas are also sensitive seafloor habitats. They host life, and they may be historically significant sites in need of further protection.
What does it feel like to know that you are looking at a part of the planet that no human eyes have ever seen before?
That's a great question. And I'm going to pass that over to our co-science lead, Jamie Austin, here, because he's one of the folks on board who really gets to help drive that component.
Yeah, I've been doing this. I've been doing ocean exploration now for about 5 years. I've been doing ocean science for 35. And the last 5 years, I've had more fun doing this than the previous 30 years doing somewhat more traditional oceanography. I feel like a kid out here. Every turn in the road is new. It's exciting. I think what Kelly talks about, the partnership that we have with stakeholders, makes it even more exciting. We put a lot of smiles on people's faces when they see the videos that we put out. It's not just the excitement of seeing the unknown. It's the confirmation that the other kinds of data that people use to help us locate dives either pay off or don't. And that can be a great validation for the kinds of collaborations we're doing.
And that's a really big goal of this expedition and our program. It's really to acquire baseline data and information in unknown regions so that we might stimulate follow-on exploration and research. A lot of times people will say, what's the difference between exploration and research? And one of the ways we like to describe that in some ways is to say that exploration generates hypotheses, whereas research seeks to answer hypotheses.
What is the most exciting thing that you've seen so far on this expedition?
I just came in from the van. I think I just saw it as a geologist. We're on a ridge on the eastern approaches to Bryant Canyon, which is one of the three big canyons in the Gulf of Mexico. One of the things we think causes these canyons are the interaction of these subsurface salts or evaporites in the Gulf with the sea surface or the seafloor. And we've just seen an enormous set of parallel channels in the seafloor. We haven't seen brines, but we have seen what the brines, I think, cause. They're very large. They're systematic. The entire slope looks unstable because of it. We haven't seen any encrusting biology in this area. And I'm in here doing an interview, but I'm also staring at the screen while we're doing it because I don't want to miss anything.
How much can you learn about, I mean, you're talking about essentially seeing evidence of the mechanism of formation of deep sea canyons. How much can you learn by just looking at them?
We all gain experience primarily by looking at what we see on land, but it's only recently that we've been able to collect on the seafloor the kinds of data that we take for granted on land. We make great maps. Mimi Lobecker and her system, her guys and the system on the ship here, it all starts with great bathymetric maps. We've got to be able, and we all know about what creates certain types of morphology based on what we've learned from our studies on land, and we can apply that to the oceans now based on the fact that we make great maps. Then what the ROVs do is they allow us to throw a dart at a map, because that's how much ground we can actually cover is the dart tip on a map like that. But then we can get some ground truth for what this morphology is actually showing us in the big picture.
I know, as exciting as seeing parts of the seafloor that have never been seen before sounds, I've been watching the feed for half an hour or so here, the video feed on the website, and most of what you guys are looking at least today, is a lot of sand, and then there's an occasional fish or an occasional shrimp. Something pops up, and then it's back to a lot of sand. Is there ever any boredom in just looking at this large landscape for hours at a time?
Not for me, but I think it's always the fact that even in areas of the seafloor that we would call monotonous, and we should keep in mind that a lot of the seafloor, particularly out in what we call abyssal plains in the big ocean basins, it's pretty flat, pretty monotonous, but the seafloor is punctuated by great interest. So when we see biology, when we see big features, I live with constant anticipation going to see something interesting. Well, today with these big drainage channels, we thought they might be there. We didn't know what they looked like. They looked different than what I expected. And so in these areas of sedimented seafloor, frankly, the biologists always like, there's a lot of biology in this monotonous looking, as you say, sand. It's actually mostly silt and clay. It's very fine-grained material. There's a lot of biology there that's of interest. One of the great ROV can do is it can zoom in great detail on areas that are millimeters across, and the scale of the biology we see, even on what you might call a monotonous seafloor. So it's almost never monotonous. It depends on who you ask.
At that point, we lost our connection to the Okeanos Explorer. Of course, at that exact moment, the live video feed of sand, sand, and more sand was interrupted by a bizarre red shape that came swimming into view. After a few minutes of ooing and aahing and some wild speculation, we got Kelly Elliott and the Okeanos Explorer team back on the line. Hi, you guys are back?
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's
our
okay. What was that red, presumably fish, fins? What was that we just saw?
It's called an Anipniastes. It's a swimming sea cucumber.
A swimming sea cucumber, bright red swimming cucumber. How big was that?
They're about 6 inches long.
That, to all of us here, looked completely alien. Is that an unusual sight? And is that the kind of moment that you guys look forward to?
It's absolutely true. That particular organism has actually been relatively common in the canyons. It swims, and then when it needs food, it goes down to the seafloor, and we've actually watched it feeding, and it sends out little hands, and they gather the soft sediment and bring it to the organism's mouth, and you can see the gut. The organism itself is dark red, and the gut is orange, so when it takes off again, you can see the gut. It's translucent. You can see right through it.
That was really spectacular. It looks like you're driving along, or the vehicle is driving along the edge of a canyon now, right along the edge of a cliff.
We're on a ridge on the edge of Bryan Canyon. That's been the goal today, is to drive along this ridge to look for deep corals. Where our primary stakeholder here is a part of NOAA that does modeling of deep coral habitat in the Gulf of Mexico. The only problem we've got is that we haven't seen any deep corals yet. We think we're seeing a lot of active geology, but no biology as a result.
So active geology, you mean that this is just, it could be slipping away at any moment?
Yeah, it's unstable. I think these channels we're seeing that we think are associated with these brines, these supersaturated salts, make the whole slope very unstable. And these corals can be hundreds to thousands of years old. And they need to attach to something firm on the seafloor, and there's nothing firm to attach to.
Now, I was asking just before we lost you guys the first time, you know, we're watching this video feed with several second delay from you guys on the ship. Your collaborators on shore are seeing it with a 2, 3, 5 second delay. Why is it so important to have all of the scientists, the contributing scientists on shore with you essentially in real time?
Well, certainly. Understand that we're coming to you from NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer, and Okeanos Explorer is the nation's first and only federal vessel with a mandate to systematically explore the world's largely unknown ocean. And since we're an exploration ship, we really don't always know what it is that we're going to find. And the ability to use telepresence to have scientists join us from shore means that depending on what we find, we can access unlimited intellectual capital. So as we're going across and making new discoveries, we can dial in experts from all over the world to view the seas in real time and provide their input and expertise not only on what it is we're seeing, but what we should do next, depending on what the discovery is.
And why is, say, a 10-second delay, even just 10 seconds, too much?
Well, I think from a logistics standpoint of moving the ROV around, in a span of 10 seconds, depending on how fast the ROV was moving, it might be very difficult for them to just go back 10 seconds in their track.
So this is Jared on the telepresence team lead for the Okeanos. I'd like to weigh on this. Essentially, what we are striving to do is to create situational awareness. We are trying, with the tools and personnel and techniques we have at hand, to bring the scientists from shore onto the ship. And the lower the lag, the faster the communications can happen, the easier we can generate meaningful communications and actionable data. If you can imagine, a really interesting fish or coral passes the screen fairly quickly. That 10-second delay could mean that we've gone beyond the ability to image that. A 2-second delay or 3-second delay, however, means that we have enough time that the scientists can stop the movement of the ROV, we can reposition, and we can essentially pivot. When we dive, we generally have goals, and we generally have things that we are looking for. However, one of the interesting things about exploration is we don't know what we're going to find. And having that intellectual capital on shore and having such a low latency allows us to essentially pivot our mission when we come across something that's interesting.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for all taking time away from your usual duties to speak with us today, and good luck with the rest of the expedition.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
We spoke with Kelly Elliott, expedition manager for the 2014 Gulf of Mexico expedition, also Jamie Austin, the lead geologist on the cruise, and Jared Druniak, the telepresence engineer for the Okeanos Explorer. And that's our show for today. If you like what you heard, like Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.